Walker.
It's great to be here.
So this week, one of the areas of activity, the House Education Committee looking at a property tax bill. There was actually another bill that was introduced, and my understanding is there's even a third on the way here. Can you give us some sense here about where things are in terms of property tax reform?
The Education Committee has been focusing on a number of different areas. One is efficiency within the system. The other is opportunity for kids, and then financing fairness. The bills that were introduced today really focus on, or that were introduced yesterday, were really focusing on efficiencies by expanding school districts, and also opportunity for kids, because the notion is with expanded school districts, there would be opportunity to avail yourself of the resources within the school district. There are now barriers created by really imaginary lines for school districts where kids who might be in one town can't go and take classes at the town right next door. So that's where the that's what they're focusing on right now. The third thing that we'll talk about in the next couple of weeks is financing fairness. There was a bill that was introduced to raise the money for the education through income tax proposal, and that I expect will get some play next week or the week after.
How is money saved through efficiency in combining districts?
Well, it can be saved a couple of ways. One, there you don't necessarily need as many administrators if you have districts that are combined. There are ways that you can share staffing when you have districts that are combined that you might not be able to do otherwise. You know, scale sometimes gives you opportunities in purchasing. So there are ways that you can save some money. You know, I think that it's important for us to try to vet and see how much money can be saved. And I think the other thing that's really important is for us not to overpromise. And the issue of trying to bring in line spending with what Vermonters can afford is going to take some time. And I think that the one thing I am really, really convinced we can't keep our, or can't take our eye off is we need to have one of the best, if not the best, school systems in the country, because that is going to be our competitive advantage over time.
Is it fair for Vermonters to assume that no matter where they live in Vermont, that they'll have a school within, what's the number? How many miles? What's a reasonable expectation?
I don't know the answer to that question. And, you know, I think a lot of people...
Is it a fair question to even ask?
I think that it is a fair question to ask. I think that the question of geography and how close the school is to where you live is an important one. And it is going to be a factor in some of the conversations around expanded school districts, because we know that there are areas where you're just not going to be able to expand the school district because you're so geographically remote. But And it really comes up in the conversation about bus rides and how long it takes to get to school. And, you know, I grew up 3 miles away from school, and I rode the bus for 45 minutes. So geographic location doesn't necessarily, or geographic proximity doesn't necessarily keep you off the bus. And, you know, I've learned some of my best life lessons on the bus as well. So
all right. Geez, I can't let that one go. I can't let that one pass. Like what?
Well, I mean, you know, you learn how to deal with conflict at the on your own on the back of the bus when the bus driver can't necessarily see what's happening. I mean, there are lots of different things that happen on the bus.
Were you establishing order at that young an age, kind of the way you do it here? Did you have a gavel when you were in fourth grade?
Wow. No, I was not.
Vaccinations have come up this week here at the State House. This question about whether the philosophical exemption should be removed. What do you think?
You know, when we had this debate the last time, I think that in 2012, the challenge around the debate was really this notion of personal choice versus public health. And, you know, what we decided to do at that point in time is see whether we could increase the vaccination rate through public education. So before we make a decision about whether we're going to remove the philosophical exemption, I'd like to see how that works. I'm really concerned about what we're seeing in other states with outbreaks of measles, a disease that was largely eradicated from this country within, only 10 years ago. And I think that the science suggests that part of the reason that we're seeing a renewal of measles outbreaks is that lower vaccination rates. So I firmly believe that vaccinations are the right thing to do from a public health standpoint. But I also think that we ought to, before we remove a philosophical exemption, I think we ought to see whether we can improve the vaccination rate in another way.
So what are you actually looking for?
Well, I want to hear from Commissioner Chen what they've done at the Department of Health to try to improve the vaccination rates in our schools. And, that to me is the critical question. And whether the education efforts that they have undertaken have been successful. I know that there are many parents out there that believe that this is a parental choice issue. And I hear that. I understand that. But, it's also an issue for kids that can't get vaccinated and want to go to school and cannot go to school because there's not a high enough vaccination rate. And so, to my way of thinking, you, by engaging in your parental choice, are determining what somebody else can or cannot do. And that's a real problem. And I think that was lost in the debate the last time.
I'm talking with the Speaker of the House, Shap Smith. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Been a couple of weeks now since the governor presented his budget. I know that it takes a little bit of time for people to really get into the details and really digest this. So what have you learned in the past week, 10 days here, that in looking at the budget that you see is either really beneficial or really problematic?
The budget is a tough budget. And, I know that people focus on Vermont and the challenges that we face. But, I think it's important for people to recognize that this is not an issue that's unique to Vermont. New Jersey's having really difficult times. Governor Christie's having to propose a budget that closes a gap. Governor Walker in Wisconsin. This is not a blue issue, a Democratic issue, or a Republican issue. People are having challenges around the country because income growth is not growing as much as we thought it would. And as a result, the tax receipts are not growing as fast as we'd hoped they would. So I just want to put it into the context because a lot of people have characterized this as a Vermont problem, and this is actually a problem that is being experienced throughout the country.
Well, I haven't heard anybody characterize that Vermont's the only place that has financial problems. I thought everybody did.
Well, not everybody does, but I think that we need to recognize that there are broader macroeconomic challenges that we're facing that mean that we really we have to understand what the structural challenges are that exist throughout the country and adopt what we're doing to those challenges that we face. So I just want to put that out in context because I know a lot of people characterize the challenges that we face as the results of things that were done 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And
right.
I just think that that's wrong. Okay. So there are very difficult challenges in the budget. We know that we are going to have to, the governor proposed about $10 million worth of savings with regard to state employees, but didn't articulate how that was going to be done. We've got to figure out how that's going to happen. There were some savings that were booked out of the education fund, and we have some real concerns about that, and we don't think that's the right way to go, but it's then incumbent on us to figure out how to deal with those. I don't like the idea of cannibalizing our lottery revenue now by putting machines in bars. The House was very clear last year that we did not think that was the way to go. We voted on an overwhelming vote not to allow that to happen. And the Senate stripped that out, and then the Lottery Commission decided to go forward with it. We have some real issues with that, and I think that in the long term, the idea of taking money from the lottery and putting it somewhere other than education is the wrong way to go. So those are areas in particular that we have some concerns about.
Is it the legislature's challenge now to figure out where to get that $10 million in savings, or do you just approve that budget and it's up to the administration to do it?
My understanding is that we approve the budget, book that savings, and then it's up to the administration to do it.
Okay. Let me have you put these on here. We're going to take a call from Williston. Sam, good morning. How's it going?
Good morning. How are we doing today?
Great. Great. Go ahead.
As far as the parent exemption is vaccination, what's the difference is I'm allowed to drink in my house, and I go into my vehicle and drive on the road. Now I'm putting people at risk. I think when we're dealing with what they consider herd vaccinations, this is what they call it, you're putting the people at risk when you don't vaccinate your children.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your call. Let me have the speaker comment.
I was wondering if there was one thing else I could ask the speaker.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
If we have a national labor board that does audits in our state, why do we need a state labor board? And I'll go from there. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Well, let me take the question about the herd immunity and the parental choice. I think I was trying to make that point previously that the consequences for other people that result because some people do not vaccinate their children are pretty significant and create, in some instances, a real public health risk. And so, you know, I think that's why it's so important to try to educate people to increase the vaccination rate. But if that doesn't work, I think we have to look at other options to try to address lower vaccination rates. You know, I don't know whether we would have been having this conversation 50 years ago, because 50 years ago, when many of these vaccinations didn't exist, people were thrilled when all of a sudden they did exist, and they prevented significant amounts of harm to children throughout the country. And we now have the luxury of having had vaccinations for 50 years and having had the benefit of that. And I think that we've forgotten what it looked like before we didn't have those things. And I don't want to go back to a time where we wish we could have vaccinated our kids. And that I think that's a real problem. And I think that we're moving backwards, not forwards, on that issue. So second point, I don't know the answer to the question. Would the National Labor Relations Board be enough to cover Vermont labor issues? My sense is probably not. They have limited resources. They tend to put them where the people are. And I would think that we may not be able to address all of the issues that revolve around Vermont labor law with if we just had the National Labor Relations Board deal with it.
Let's take another call here. We go to Cabot. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. Earlier on, I think I heard your guest say that he wanted not to have the best education system in the country. And so my question is, what does he mean? What's the operational definition?
Okay. All right.
What do I mean by that?
Yeah.
I think that our students should score either at the top or in the top three on national test scores for the country. My goal is for us to have the best graduation rate, which we do now or often are in the top three, to have the top scores, science, math, writing, and for us to have a significantly higher rate of kids that go to pursue some sort of education after high school. And I'm not saying just college, because I don't think just college is for everybody. I think that people ought to have the opportunities to get further education for trades and for technical education. So my view is I want to make sure that all of our kids are ready to be citizens of the state and of the country and have the education to effectively engage in that those activities. And I want all of our kids to be in a place where they have economic opportunities and they have the skills to move up the economic ladder. So that's what I mean when I say I think we ought to have the best education system in the country.
Let me take one more call here. We go to Faiston. Freddie, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Speaker.
Good morning.
Two things. One, I'll go to the education after I do the vaccines. But as far as vaccinations go, I just sent Adam Gresham, who's my rep, an email with my thoughts on this, and that is my children were vaccinated, and all of my animals are vaccinated. Since my children were young, there are many more vaccines available and that are being administered. With our animals, we don't just give them a shot because it's time. We test titers. You know, we run a blood count to see if, you know, they need that shot. And we don't administer all the shots at once. And when we do administer more than one shot at a time, we do it on a different part of the body. So we know if there's a reaction to that drug or to something in that shot. So then we can use a different brand, which maybe has a different carrier or something, so that you don't continue to increase the reaction.
Okay, I got to interrupt here. Could you get to the education question briefly, because I got to let the speaker go here.
Oh, okay. So then as far as education, I think he's what his goals are fair. I think just saying best in the country is pretty limiting. I think there's a whole big world out there, and we should be looking at ourselves worldwide. And
okay.
I think that he doesn't have a plan. He says what the goal is, but how are we going to get there? Because I think if we don't address that, we're just shuffling, excuse me, shuffling deck chairs. Okay.
Thank you for your call.
So let me take the vaccination question first. I agree that the slate of vaccinations that are now considered mandatory has broadened a great deal, and I think that we ought to take a look at what we think are critical to public health and make sure that we're not requiring vaccinations that we don't need to. Okay, so that's the first thing. With regard to the education, you know, we have, it is true that we have sort of a complicated system now, and trying to point 250 school districts in one direction so that we have a systematic push to be the best in the world. I'll be fine with best in the world. I don't need to be limited by best in the country. Is tricky. I do think that we do have a plan with regard to, we think that they're streamlining and expanding school districts will give kids more opportunity. It will also create administrative efficiencies. And we are also looking at ways that we can change the financing system so that it's more fair. So, you know, if the person from Faiston, I think it was Faiston, has some ideas, all ears. Love to hear them. If she has a plan, we will definitely take a look at it.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Speaker. Speaker Shap Smith joining us. We're going to take a short break. Coming up next, we'll talk with Ken Schatz. He's the Commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. We're broadcasting live at the State House. It's Friday. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back right after this.
It's no secret Mejuron Supermarket is a great place to shop. I'm Tom Mejuron. For over seven decades, Mejuron's has been catering to the needs of the Mad River Valley and beyond. We have custom-cut meats, fresh produce and seafood, regular and organic grocery, locally produced foods galore, topped off by an extraordinary wine and beer department and a state liquor agency. Shop Mejuron Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center, Waitsfield.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
Big fish and big prizes. The 11th annual Northeast Gig'em Ice Fishing Derby is February 12th through 15th on lakes and ponds throughout the Northeast Kingdom. For details, log on to WrightSportsShop.com and cast your line for cash and prizes thanks to fine sponsors like Community National Bank, Lenny Shoe and Apparel, and Champlain Valley Equipment. Call 334-6115 to register for the 11th annual Northeast Kingdom Ice Fishing Derby.
Broadcasting live this morning at the State House in Montpelier. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Ken Schatz. Ken is the new commissioner, relatively new commissioner, of the Department of Children and Families, and he's kind enough to join us here this morning. Ken, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Mark. Thank you.
Actually, Ken and I have known each other for quite a few years back in his one of his previous lives as the Burlington City Attorney. My goodness, why did you take this job anyway?
You know, Secretary, I hadn't been looking for it. Secretary Chen asked me about it. At the time, Commissioner Iacovone was, I think, dealing very well with some challenging situations, and I learned that he had decided to move on. I had to think about it. The reality is I do have some background as being involved as an attorney for children in the child protection system, although I then moved on, as you indicated, to being city attorney in Burlington. And as I thought about it, the child protection system is incredibly important for the people of Vermont. It's obviously a challenge, and I felt that I wanted to, having been asked, do the best I could to help improve the system.
You certainly came in when things were really quite tumultuous.
There's no doubt about that. The reality is, the two horrific fatalities that had occurred over now the last year have gotten everybody's attention to the critical need and issues that are faced by our child protection system. And so it was definitely, and it continues to be, a tumultuous time, but again, an opportunity to look at our system to figure out how we can improve.
There was a pretty significant report that was done after those two deaths, which I'm going to oversimplify it for the sake of our discussion here, which concluded, one of the conclusions was that the department put too much focus on reuniting families. Can you talk about that and that conclusion that was reached?
Sure.
And whether it's fair?
Well, I think it's important to maybe step back and realize that our goal when we get involved in the life of a child and family is to protect the child and to achieve permanency for the child, so that we will remove children from the home in those circumstances where the child is at risk. The question then becomes, foster care is not a good permanent solution for the child. So what we need to look at is, has the situation at home been improved so that maybe the child is ready to be reunified with the family, or is it more likely that, frankly, the parents will not be able to appropriately care for the child, in which case we should move towards a more permanent situation like adoption.
Mm-hmm.
I think what has happened over time was, even though I believe our policies are very clear and most of our social workers are excellent and really understand, our policy is to protect child in the first instance and to look at reunification as a model that does oftentimes work but is not always the most appropriate approach. I think that some of the information that we learned after those fatalities were that we needed to clarify that message. So we appreciate and accept the fact that we, and I think our social workers understand now, as a result of the inquiry, as a result of the recommendations, that our focus is reunification. And it is not reunification as the primary approach. The primary approach is protection of the child. Reunification is certainly something that may occur once we believe the family is ready to appropriately care for the child and the child would be safe there.
We're talking with Ken Schatz. He's the commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. I know 2020 hindsight is really beautiful. So when you ultimately look back on these two deaths here, what do you conclude with 2020 hindsight? What went wrong?
I think that what we have recognized is that maybe it's a renewed appreciation for how challenging social workers' role is. These are incredibly difficult familial situations. Social workers have to make very difficult judgment decisions. They work very hard, very committed. What we need to do is give them the appropriate resources. We need to give them the appropriate workload so that they can have the ability to make those decisions appropriately. We need to give them appropriate guidance. And I think what we've learned is that we need to put all of that together to continue to do the best we can. I think that the governor and the secretaries and Commissioner Iacovone took some immediate steps in terms of recognizing that resources was a major part of this issue. And in effect, since the summer, we've received 32 positions to implement and improve our level of resources for the Family Services Division. Some of those are directly social workers in the field. Some of those are our positions within our central office to make sure we have appropriate policy and training resources. But I think that we're moving forward.
Because I did notice, I want you to talk a little bit more about that personnel increase, because I noticed in the first round of it, there were, I think it was 10 people that were at it, and it was all administrative. It was none of them were people that were actually hands-on people. So of this 32, how many are actually social workers?
I would say approximately 22, and let me clarify. Actually, the first move we made was to put 18 social workers in the field. The 10, I think, that you're talking about actually have that authorization has come later. But we put immediately, and we filled 17 positions relatively quickly for social workers in the field all around the state.
And so social workers today, are they overwhelmed with the caseload or not?
Well, we still candidly have high caseloads. I mean, I really appreciate the commitment of the social workers to trying to get the job done. One of the things that happened was, even though we added these new social workers around the state, which initially did reduce their workload, unfortunately, we've now seen an increase in our caseload because we have an increased number of child abuse reports. We have an increased number of children coming into state custody, including a significant increase in young children coming into custody. We believe that that is a reflection of the substance abuse issues that are prevalent in our community and are simply affecting parents who sometimes simply are not taking appropriate care of their children when they're involved with substance abuse.
Well, we're talking to Ken Schatz, new commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. You can join us at 244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. I want to remind you about our friends up the road at Jet Service Envelope. You can find them at 229-9335. If you have any sort of printing projects that need to get done, they can make it happen for you. Everything from publishing books to trifold brochures, other paper products, anything ink and paper goes together on, they can make it happen for you. They can also make great calendars for you. It is not too late in the year. We got, 11 months to go here. So give them a call today. You can call them at 229-9335. Get a lot more information at jetservice-envelope.com. All right, so Ken, let me ask you sort of a larger philosophical question here. You just mentioned the substance abuse problem. We're talking about opiate addiction, heroin addiction. But what is really going on out there? Why do we seem to have just this enormous number of complaints and cases of abuse of children?
I think there's a variety of factors that are at play here. I think that families continue to have economic stress. I think that the issues related to substance abuse we're learning more about why people tend to sometimes be taking prescription drugs and then abuse that and become more addicted. But I think that While I can't tell you that I have the magic answer to why this is happening, what I do think is that we're coming together to recognize that we need to have a community-based approach to addressing the issue. The child protection in and of itself is not going to solve this problem. I think that looking at issues related to substance abuse as a community enables prevention programs to be identified and implemented to make sure that we provide parent education in an appropriate manner. I think that's an important part of then Secretary Chen's recommendations to the governor. We're working on implementing that recommendation. I think support for our nonprofit partners, designated agencies, and parent-child centers to work with families and children in a before there is a significant problem is also part of our approach. The Agency of Human Services is implementing a uniform screening tool so that when individuals come into contact with any of the agency offices, that we can try to identify whether there is a risk of substance abuse early on so that we can offer treatment in a manner that will enable someone who's at some risk of alcohol or substance abuse to undertake that treatment, because that we want to enable those things to happen early. Definitely, you know, the evidence indicates that early intervention is much more successful than waiting till there's a crisis.
Mm-hmm. Can you help me understand the substance abuse question better? Do people that are on opiates, I mean, they're not... I mean, when people are on alcohol, they abuse their children by hitting them. When somebody's on an opiate, is it more neglect than hitting them? Or what's the child abuse, quote-unquote, here?
Well, I think that, it's a range. And again, I'm not going to pretend to be the expert on this. I think there's others with more expertise. But I do think that we frankly see a range. Sometimes there is abuse, but more often, frankly, it is... someone who is addicted is putting their desires and needs for substances over and above their taking care of their child, so that we do see more situations where they're being neglectful. And that is of great concern to us, of course. And when we see those situations, we want to intervene to make sure we protect the child.
Mm-hmm. Are there enough people out there, if you need to take kids out of homes, are there enough places to put these kids?
Well, I appreciate the question. We actually are constantly trying to engage with foster parents to make sure that we have enough foster parents, that we train them well, we continue to, frankly, need more responsible foster parents to help us as we've seen the number of children in custody grow. So it is an ongoing need, and I appreciate your question. Frankly, if there are folks out there who are interested in becoming foster parents, I encourage them to contact our office.
Mm-hmm. Hard work, though.
It is very hard work. I mean, there's no question. Foster parents, you know, are an invaluable partner and asset to our system. We have an incredible number of committed, wonderful, helpful families who really care about the kids they serve, and we greatly appreciate the role they play.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's take a call from Waitsfield. Peter, good morning. How are you?
Good, and good morning to you. Just to comment on the substance abuse as far as opiates is concerned, this is just a theory on my part, but I believe that because opiates are illegal and the price is high as a result, and that the neglect or the effort of the addict to feed their addiction takes more resources from the home simply because opiates are illegal. If they were, opiate addicts were given a maintenance dose of opiate, as was done in Britain, I think a lot of the problems we are seeing in families as far as their chasing their addiction would be reduced, and their children's lives might be better.
All right. Let me have Ken comment. Thank you for your call.
I think what I would say is that I believe the Department of Health is working very hard to develop enhanced capacity for treatment and also protocols so that, and I think there is, I think, ongoing efforts to work with and educate doctors to try to make sure that we are cognizant of the issues related to substance abuse, and hopefully I think there has been some recognition of the need to make sure that when people are prescribed prescription drugs, that that's done in an appropriate manner.
How many months have you been in this job now?
About 4.5 months.
All right, so what have you learned? What have you learned in the past 4.5 months that you're saying to yourself after 4.5 months, wow, I had no idea, dot, dot, dot?
You know, what I've actually learned in, is a variety of things. One is to obtain much greater appreciation for the committed social workers that we have, despite the challenges that we face. I mean, I really do appreciate that. But I've also learned that the kind of range of families who become involved with DCF is really broad. It is across the across the range of economic issues, and so you really have to have an even-handed approach to address these issues. I've also learned that, as I mentioned earlier, that this is not a problem that DCF can solve by itself in terms of child protection. The reality is, one of the things about the Department for Children and Services is that we have a broad range of activities, and that the connections to Reach Up program, the connection to our homeless activities are actually quite important. So I've come to realize that we are seeing, for example, many more families with children who are homeless, and that is clearly of great concern, and so I've realized that we need to make those connections better, to recognize that in order to protect children, we need to also address issues like homelessness, so that we can have a situation where, frankly, we avoid the kind of pressures on families that can sometimes lead to abuse and neglect. I mean, and to that end, you know, the Agency of Human Services is working with other partners to end family homelessness by 2020. I think that's an important goal, and it actually, what I've learned is that that's really not separate from the issues of child protection. It's actually very related, and we need to have that broad-based approach if we are really committed to protecting children.
What's done to prevent social workers from getting completely burned out?
That's a great question, and I think we probably need to do more to support them. We are seeing some turnover that's higher than we'd like, and I think that we need to make sure we provide them with manageable, reasonable caseloads. We need to make sure we provide them with appropriate training. We need to provide them with appropriate supervision, but also give them the respect that they deserve, so that they can, you know, feel fulfilled even as they make every day incredibly difficult and challenging decisions, and frankly are faced with very heart-rending situations that they have to face, have to try to figure out how best to protect children. So I think we can't do enough to support them.
Are they getting the respect today or not from the public?
I mean, I think that I think we can do better. I mean, I think on an individual level, I think certainly sometimes I do hear supported they are, but obviously one of the things about particularly these two fatalities is, I think sometimes they perceive that the approach is simply negative and not appreciative of all the hard work that they do. And again, I think that I appreciate on an individual level that there is support across the community, but sometimes I do appreciate this, that it's hard for a social worker to know and feel that they're getting the kind of support that they deserve.
One of the issues that came up after the two deaths also involved training. How has training changed, if anything, within the agency?
I think that we're more mindful of the need to constantly support and renew training. I think we've always had good training, but we can improve it. I think some of the, you referenced some of the reports. So, for example, the Casey Family Programs and the Vermont Citizens Advisory Board made some specific recommendations about training, and I think that we can implement those to sort of bring our training up to utilizing best practices and the take advantage of the expertise that exists around the country. For example, specifically with respect to substance abuse issues, obviously an important issue we've already talked about. We are engaging consultation with the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare to take advantage of the their expertise around the country to help us train our social workers on how best to address those issues with families.
Getting back to just sort of this, what you've learned here in the past 4.5 months, can you say here today, 4.5 months later, that the level of abuse of children in this state was a lot higher than you thought it was when you took the job?
You know, I think that I don't know. To be honest, because I didn't know the level of abuse before I started, that I can make that comparison. But what I will say is, it has surprised me that the increase in child abuse reports, the increase in custody, has occurred, and that does, of course, concern me greatly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the piece of legislation that's winding its way here through the building. One of the big issues that's come out of this is whether or not, quote-unquote, caregivers should somehow be held more accountable if something happens to a child. And you raised some concerns about this bill. What are your concerns about it?
So the bill, as initially proposed, I did express my concerns because I thought that the language was too broad, that it did impose potential criminal liability on people who had custody or care of a child, including social workers, including family members, where it wasn't clear what their duty was. Having said that, I do understand the concern and share the desire to protect children. We certainly, though, I think, want to focus on the perpetrators of abuse or physical harm to a child. What I really do appreciate is that legislators, I think, have listened. It's my understanding they're working on narrowing the language of that. I look forward to reviewing the proposed language and working with them to see if we can find an appropriate balance. What we don't want to have is a situation where people are afraid, including social workers, are afraid to make appropriate choices when trying to serve families. We want to make sure that we don't provide any disincentives to families to engage in treatment. But I think that I think the legislature has heard that, and we'll keep working with the legislature and hope that we can address this in a positive manner.
Is this question, though, about people that aren't necessarily a parent who may be in some sort of maybe living in the house with a child? I mean, is there a need to change the law so that you can, for lack of a better term, get at those people?
Well, I think that is the question that's being discussed, and I think that what we're trying to understand and figure out is what's the extent of that problem and what's the right course in terms of addressing it. From DCF's perspective, if a child is being harmed, we have and want to make sure we have the tools in the child protection system to address that child's needs. That's from our perspective, and I believe that the work that the legislature has done and we are working with them is to clarify some of the definitions in our statute to enable us to appropriately address those situations.
Okay. Is the way it stands right now? What needs to change, Ken?
There's language that we are working with the legislature on to clarify harm and risk of harm, particularly in a circumstance with respect to substance abuse, where it was identified that we really didn't talk about substance abuse in our child protection statute, and we've agreed that it does make sense to do that, and we're working with the legislature on language that will enable us to act when there is a connection between substance abuse and the failure to appropriately care for a child. So it's that connection that's important with respect to really making sure that we protect children, but at the same time not inappropriately providing a disincentive to treatment.
Is it child abuse if there's the presence of narcotics or drugs in the house?
So our position is that it becomes child abuse is when that use of narcotics results in harm to the child, so that there needs to be a connection between the behavior of the parent and the well-being of the child.
Okay. Are there enough, is there, the way it stands right now, does DCF have enough authority, or does that authority need to be enhanced in the ability to take a child out of a home?
I believe we do have adequate language in the statute and appropriate policies and practices to address those situations. I think the work the legislature is doing will support that.
Okay.
Going forward.
Okay. So what more do you, what do you want in this bill? What do want?
There's actually some things that are very going to be, I think, very helpful in this bill in terms of, for example, to the language, as I just mentioned, about clarifying the language about harm to make it more clear when we can intervene in appropriately in circumstances related to substance abuse. There's some language in there about special investigative units, which is the law enforcement arm that have special training and expertise in the area of child abuse. The legislature, I think, is doing some really good work to clarify when they can intervene and when we can work with them. We believe that will be very helpful. Another area that we think is very positive is looking at post-adoption contact agreements. Going back to the discussion we had about permanency,
right.
Adoption is oftentimes an appropriate way to enable a child's life to be on a stable footing. And one of the things about adoptions, obviously, it means is that the birth parents lose their parental rights. That can often be a contentious process. What this bill is working on is allowing, if there's mutual agreement, including by the adoptive parent, natural parents might be able to continue to have some contact with their child, even if the child is actually adopted. Wanting to make sure that the language makes it clear that the adoptive parent has to agree, but with that in mind, it can result in a situation where children can get that permanent adoptive home without as many adversarial contentions hearings. It could happen quicker, so we see that as a very positive thing. There's also language in the bill that we will believe one of the other issues that candidly came up in the context of the fatalities was the sharing of information between DCF, law enforcement, yeah. and other partners in the child protection system. And we think there's some language that the legislature proposed and we are working on with them that will clarify the law with respect to our ability to share information, which we see as very positive.
What was the lack of information sharing that was problematic in those two cases?
Well, in the reports that were issued, there was some individuals involved in the system who felt that they didn't get all the information they would have liked to have received from DCF about the child, including some of the attorneys involved in the situation, the guardian ad litem, and part of that had to do with to a certain extent, our practice was we make that those information records available to them upon request, and I think that one of the things that the law that's going through the bill that's going through the legislature right now will clarify that in certain circumstances we should provide information to those partners in the system automatically. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to us. We're glad to do that. And so what we can do is perhaps move, that will enable us to move the sharing of information along quicker and hopefully enable all the participants in this process to have more information to make better decisions.
Is it confidentiality issues that's prevented this before?
Our perspective is confidentiality with respect to partners in the child protection system is not an obstacle, but I think what the bill does again is helps to clarify that situation. I think one of the things about confidentiality is there's sometimes a perception and that certain information can't be shared when in fact there actually isn't a legal obstacle. That is, you know, with respect to service providers, with respect to the parties involved in the child protection judicial process, we can share information, but sometimes people are unclear about that. And again, I think the legislation will help to remedy that misunderstanding to the extent it exists.
Mm. I'm not sure I understood you there. Can you give me an example of information that would be helpful to get around the system that
Sure.
you couldn't before?
Well, again, I think we could, but there's a couple. So service providers or educators, and maybe that's an example, educators who are providing service to children, I think there's been sometimes a lack of clarity about what information they can obtain regarding a child who's involved with DCF.
Like what?
Sometimes they'd want it. Well, it can range from whether they are in a foster home, and if so, where.
Okay.
In terms of what the actual present situation is with their family, I think that what this law will enable us to do and clarify for all the partners is share information like that.
Talking with Ken Schatz, he's the Commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. Last question for you. Is your agency too much reactive and not proactive, or is that just the role that your agency plays in the system?
Well, I do appreciate that question. I think we do both. And when, you know, the Department for Children and Families is broad enough to encompass both the proactive and the reactive. You know, the child protection system, you know, to a certain extent is reactive, to be sure, because in fact, you know, we abuse and neglect reports come in and we need to and want to respond. But at the same time, I do think it's important to be more proactive, to work with communities. And our child development division does a lot of work in the community with early learning programs. The state, as you may know, has received a substantial grant called Race to the Top to provide early learning opportunities. We also do a lot of work going back to the situation regarding the homeless through our Office of Economic Opportunity and our Economic Service Division through our safety net programs. And so we do a lot of things that are proactive as a department. Clearly, there's room to do more. Resources are always an issue. But working with our partners in the community, like parent-child centers, like designated agencies, we definitely want to continue and to the extent we can be more effective in providing those kind of proactive approaches to build community, to enable families to be healthy so that the issues of child abuse and neglect don't occur.
So is the balance between proactive and reactive okay today, right now?
Well, I think we can always do more in terms of prevention. I'd love to see us doing more.
I know that. I mean, you can always do that. But, I mean, as it stands today, is it way out of whack here or not?
I think that what I would say is we do a lot in the prevention mode. I guess what I would say is I don't know that it's way out of whack. But could we do more? Absolutely.
What would an individual do? You mentioned supporting social workers. So how would you do that? Give me an example.
I think that I appreciate that question. I think that engage in your community to support foster parents by reaching out, to support social workers by, if you know them, to let them know you appreciate their work. You know, letters to the editor to let community folks know, especially if you have good interactions, to let them know. And you know, candidly, I want to be clear, we want to hear good things, but we also know that there's opportunities for constructive criticism, and we appreciate that too. But I think to support social workers, on an individual level, as in addition to a community level, is actually very important.
Mm-hmm.
It would be helpful.
Here's my real last question. So when somebody is involved in one of these cases that involves a death, I mean, this has got to be really traumatic for the social worker, too. What do you do to help that person?
We do have, a system that provides emotional assistance if it's needed. It may not be needed. We've talked about whether or not what things we can do more to support our social workers in that situation. I think that's kind of an ongoing process for that.
What do you do today?
Well, I think that
you take them out of the field like you might with a police officer.
We don't have that as an automatic. We don't have that. And that's actually what I was thinking and what we have been talking about is whether we might, as the police do, give somebody in that circumstance an immediate break.
So people involved in those cases had to go back to work the next day and work on continuing cases.
They did. And, I give them great credit. I think that on an individual level, we do try to support them. But we at the present time, we don't have an automatic response. And it is something we're thinking. thinking and looking at.
Thank you for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
Ken Schatz is the commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. That's going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Thanks for joining us on the program. We're broadcasting live this morning at the State House. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. News is coming your way next.